So here's the timeline. My basic argument is that we are now in a renaissance of the mainframe world, which hasn't been seen for 30 years. And I want to go through that because the analogies from a technical point of view are kind of important. So just here's the broad timeline. The 60s and 70s were dominated by first IBM and then all of the baby IBM selling mini computers, but they were essentially two versions of the same thing. For roughly 15 years afterwards, and I've marked 1981 because that was the year of the release of the IBM PC, you had the old world of the personal computer. And we'll get into some things about that in a minute because it actually arguably starts before then, but that's the period of dominance. Then you have the 6 years of the dot com was most active when you had very much of an overlap in the two worlds. And for the last decade, we've had this new mainframe world. Now, like it says in the disclaimers, I'm glossing over a lot of detail completely on purpose. I have a motto, which is always play to win. And so I want to focus on the things that were most successful because that's the real goal if you're going to play to win. Any number of other ways to play for personal identity, play because your friends are playing, play because you want something to do. You know, always play to win. That's what I'm focused on. So there's the timeline. Now I'll go back to video and I'll go through this because you could just read my slides, but that's not gonna, I hate that. I hate that part of. There we are. Okay. So it used to be that there were not IT departments, there were IS departments. And there was this motto that went around in that era of what was called the priesthood. And the priesthood were the people that ran the machines, and they were typified by a trade magazine called Datamation, which I read when I was very young occasionally. And Datamation was all about all about the priesthood. And in so many ways, the personal computer was a reaction to that priesthood, and very consciously so, that they were trying to overthrow an established order that was restricting the access to this technology, for one reason or another. But the computers at that time were expensive single units. They tended to be owned by large companies and other largest institutions like universities. They were relatively tightly controlled because of the expense, but there are plenty of enthusiasts who wanted to get access to that kind of stuff. And so throughout the 70s was brewing a whole foment to overturn the mainframe. So the first wave of this was actually in the mainframe industry, which was the creation of mini computers, which were essentially smaller mainframes that could be run by smaller departments. Divisions within a corporation rather than for the corporation as a whole. So they still had a priesthood, but the priesthood was already broadening by then. And mini computers developed a slightly different culture than mainframes had. They had new programming languages and the like. So, but all of the elements are there. You had centralized computers, you had page mode terminals, which is what browsers are nowadays, you had centralized application delivery, and you had a restriction of what you could do based on what the people who ran the mainframe wanted you to be able to do. And those are the elements that have persisted into the present. So during the 70s, you had the beginnings of the PC disruption that would occur roughly a decade later. And the real first marker for this is the Xerox Alto from 1973. This was a machine that Steve Jobs basically copied in terms of its design to build the Lisa and then the Macintosh. So it's from Xerox PARC, and Doug Engelbart was working at PARC then, and this was the first machine that went into any production that had a mouse on it. It had a graphical user interface, it had object-oriented operating systems and languages. In so many ways, the Xerox Alto typified what Mac OS became, particularly, I mean, including the use of Objective-C. So it wasn't a commercial product, There were only a few hundred ever built, but they were heavily used in Xerox and a few other places, and they never achieved commercial success because of Xerox's own internal limitations. But it's really the first, in many ways, it's the first modern PC. So after the Xerox Alto, in parallel, there was a whole era of kit building. So the MITS Altair, which was the S100 bus system that had plug-in cards and front light switches and blinky lights to program it, where paper tape was a optional peripheral to be using it. There were a whole lot of enthusiast computers that were in the pages of Popular Electronics and Radio and Electronics in the U.S. and done by engineers with a very narrow market. Now, this environment is significant, and I mention it mostly because this is where Bill Gates got his start. He was selling basic interpreters into the S100 market starting in 1975. And then the last major milestone in this early era is the Apple II, which is 1977. And it was the first real successful mass market computer and was followed by several other kinds of things like the Commodore 64 and the Altair ZX. I forget the 81. I forget the actual numbers. Anyway, there were a number of like smallish 8-bit 64K machines that came on the heels of the Apple II. But the real PC world begins with the IBM PC in 1981. And this is the thing that begins the revolution inside the IS departments. So the hardware of this world was all based on PC clones. The software was based on Microsoft operating systems and productivity applications from major vendors. Everything else during this period, including Apple, was a niche. Apple had never in this whole 15 years, never more than 10% market share for anything. So there was a huge, you can see, cultural resentment building in Apple for never having been successful for this long period of time. And if you've seen, there's a webcomic guy who has a T-shirt that says, "I was an Apple fan when they were doomed." And this is that period of Apple's history when they had horrible problems breaking into the market because they really weren't corporately oriented then and hadn't found consumer success yet. So as this world evolves, you have not much difference between the consumer and the corporate market overall. They're pretty much running the same kinds of applications with slight difference in focus, but roughly the same technologies. This is the period where IS departments start calling themselves IT departments. This is kind of the first wave of increase in IT spending. Nothing like happened during the dot-com thing, but there was a slow build in terms of people pursuing IT. And this is also the period when certain fairly far-sighted companies like Federal Express started investing in IT fairly heavily. That didn't become de rigueur until later, but this is the period when some people gain particular commercial advantage because of it. And so the technology doesn't really move particularly fast, except for the kind of Moore's Law increases in capacity. So processor, RAM, display disk, all those things increased. That was where most of the action was. But in terms of total capability, things didn't change much. And the only two things that really changed in this period were local networking got to be prominent, starting with Novell, and later Microsoft added their own stuff. And then graphic user interfaces and mice. That's basically corresponds to the introduction of Windows 3. Which happened near the end of that. But it's not exactly a period of stagnation, but the avenues of growth were relatively constrained. And not much was really changing in terms of the type of interaction, the type of things that were happening. So the end of this period happens in the mid-90s, and the real marker is Netscape. But before Netscape, there were a bunch of harbingers of the dot-com period. And they boil down into two categories, corresponding roughly to ARPANET and the BBS world with modems. So you had these two parallel tracks that really converged. So ARPANET starts in 1969, develops TCP/IP, and becomes the internet. But then you also have the same in the same world prior to that all working widely, you have UUCP, which is running on dial-up modems. And for personal computers, you have the BBS networks and things, BBS, individual BBSs and things like FidoNet, which was the most successful of the interoperation of BBSs at the time. So those are the two main trends in networking at the time. And near the end of this period, you had the growth of online services, which has always kind of been there, but had not really gotten significant until AOL. And AOL is really a marker in how to kill a dominant player if you're an upstart. And it's a useful lesson to remember about why AOL ended up failing. I won't really go into that right now, but basic reason AOL failed is that open internet networking standards caused AOL to have to talk to the outside web, and then they didn't do a good job of providing value on top of that. So one way of responding to dominant players is to standardize the hell out of the environment they have to play in and force them through consumer pressure to interoperate with you, and that'll destroy a lot of the uniqueness of their value. So we'll get into more detail of that when I talk about Facebook. So, but the dominant applications of this time are still all with us, and they develop during this period, and they are still in some ways the canonical things you've got to do if you're going to do things right. And they are email, which, SMTP, file distribution, which was initially FTP, discussion boards, which were originally Usenet and changed into hosted things later, and then chat, which is kind of a latecomer, but IRC is still with us and becoming, and its successor, XMPP, is gaining ever more dominance in terms of having captured that niche. Okay, so what happened with the web? Well, during this period of the dot-com, the main thing that changed was Mosaic, which integrated multimedia into the World Wide Web and created the browser as an application category. Now, the original browsers were productivity applications very much like your word processor. That's how they were seen as. They turned out to be something utterly different because Netscape decided that they wanted to start delivering applications through the browser, which by hook or by crook basically happened, although not in the way they wanted. They went out of business before it happened. They didn't have the right technology, but there was a big grudge match between Netscape and Microsoft at the time, and Microsoft basically lost. Netscape committed suicide in the process, but Microsoft didn't win that battle, and the consequences are still with us today. So during this 5-year period of overlap or something, progress in the personal computer world basically stagnated. There wasn't really a lot of action in the desktop world. Microsoft certainly wasn't paying attention to it. They had product groups for their desktop applications that were churning out new versions occasionally, but no one was particularly paying attention to them. And so what's happening in this period is that all the activity for most all of the hacker crowd, myself included, I have to admit, had gone into thinking about what do you do with the internet with respect to personal computers, and in particular, how do you make money at it? And this is the environment where the energy gets sucked out of the PC and moves into the mainframe. Now, during this period, it's not on the mainframe entirely, mostly because of technological immaturity, but that was soon to change. So in the last decade, you've had all sorts of stuff that's moved your applications off the PC. And in fact, people have started tossing their PCs using their MacBook Air or whatever just as a browser terminal. It's largely the only application on the thing. Maybe iTunes is on it as well. But a very restricted set of things on the personal computer. Generally using off-site things. The browser is a new page mode terminal, applications from neo mainframes, and most importantly, the peer-to-peer principle becomes the host terminal principle. And that thing has really become dominant in terms of the way people think about stuff. So this is where you get software as a service. I have an old colleague who's selling infrastructure as a service, but anything that ends in AAS as a service is a neo mainframe kind of play. So if you like autonomy, this should be frightening. Because if this were to succeed in its entirety, you'd end up with a social environment which is centralized technically, which would later tend to become centralized politically. That's simply the way of such things. And without being too hysterical about it, one of the main things that characterized fascism more than other forms of totalitarianism was the integration of the interests of the corporation and the state. And so you've got a technical trend with moving everything onto mainframes, which can't end well 20, 30 years hence. I don't think there's any, I'm not worried about any particularly immediate problem with it. But this is, in many ways, the origin of my concern about this, is that it's heading down a very, very bad road. So, also in this last half, just in the last 5 years or so, we've seen smartphones and tablets start to succeed. The PC is the device of choice of ordinary people. It's also concomitantly increased the number of users by huge amounts. So you have to just acknowledge that this is the kind of thing people would rather use rather than desktop computers of the Xerox Alto mold. So basically, the Alto style of computer design had its dominance from 1973 to, let's just say, the introduction of the iPhone in 2007. So it had a good 30-odd year run, and its day is fading now. Now, the real issue with smartphones is that personal computers always, they basically didn't change in terms of their basic relationship between the vendor of the computer and the software you installed on it. It was your responsibility to put the software on it and your responsibility to deal with it. Well, that really changed with smartphones, and largely they were able to do this because, at least in the US initially, they were tied very tightly to cell phone carriers. So, as is infamous, Apple had an exclusive deal with AT&T for the first few years of the iPhone sales, which everyone resented. But the integration between Apple and the network carrier and the device led to something which greatly decreased the old PC principle of even being able to control your own device. So the way I like to view smartphones is that they come pre-compromised out of the box when you open them. I don't trust the damn things for anything. I have one. I don't have anything particularly important on it. I resent the fact that my address book is on it, even though my address book is not shared with Google. I can go on and rant, but I don't think I need to. In particular, the tying to the network service, be it Google or Apple, is a specific point of departure from the previous way that such small things had been designed, where they were tied to some other device, typically, I mean, a personal computer at the time, but the Palm Pilot was an example of a device that had the right idea, is that when you have a device that you use ordinarily, you tie it to some other device that's in your personal control. Now, I don't think that needs to be a traditional PC going forward, but they did have the basically right architecture that you want to link that thing to something else you own for any number of reasons, which I'll enumerate in great detail later. And so the latest thing in the mainframe world, which is basically going to be the moniker for it, I'm afraid, is the cloud. So anytime you hear the cloud, you can think neo mainframe, and you'll be completely accurate. Okay. So that's a rather depressing picture. And there are a couple of remnants that aren't part of that picture that are nevertheless important. And it's worthwhile talking about them specifically because they provide both one hope and two points of entry on what to do different. So the first one are discussion forums. Now, originally that was Usenet. And while Usenet's still around, it's by no means the dominant way that people have forum discussions with each other. Outside of Facebook and other the major hosted services, the unique thing about forum software is that it tends to be run, they tend to be written in PHP, running on hosting services, operating autonomously in a community of interest. So it's one of the few places where you actually, even though technically speaking it's a hosted service, they tend not to be hosted by major vendors out to eliminate your privacy. So there's an important aspect of autonomy in that particular world, which is worth paying attention to because it's a point of entry where you don't have to overthrow a dominant player with a lot of money. And the other one where there's still a significant amount of autonomy is chat. And people still use IRC all the time. I mean, even when Skype, Microsoft, Windows Messenger, AOL, AIM, any number of these other private clients, they're still talking IRC protocol or XMPP, and they're still able to interoperate with other chat systems. So chat has managed to basically hold its own against these incumbent players. And part of the reason for that is that you had to have client software to run it, and it wasn't really appropriate to deliver chat through a browser. People have done it. You can certainly write one in JavaScript. But for various reasons, not the least being interoperation and installed base, browser-delivered chat services never really took off, which I find perfectly good. And the last two exceptions are mighty important, and I've left them for last on purpose. The first one is BitTorrent, which is significant only because it's the application that creates the most traffic on the internet. And the thing to know about BitTorrent is that piracy really is a killer app. Should not be denied. I know because I don't talk about this a lot, but Bram Cohen was my employee in 98, 99, and we were designing such things, the ideas behind BitTorrent. Many of them were developed during that period. I was rather interested during those years with an old piece of BBS over the internet software called Hotline, which used a concept called the tracker, which BitTorrent picked up to act like a private namespace. So there's some interesting issues involving private namespaces and things that come out of that. Nevertheless, BitTorrent is one of the reasons BitTorrent has held its own is that it absolutely requires client software that cannot be delivered through a browser without basically installing a BitTorrent extension into your browser. So there's no difference really in terms of the software installed between a browser extension and a separate client. So that's one place where you really have a major system that's completely operating in the old mode, in the old peer-to-peer end-to-end mode. And the other one is Skype, which we're using right now. And Skype is kind of fascinating. It grew out of the people who wrote Kazaa, and the architecture was originally written on it. Even though it was closed source for profit, they've done a really good job building the right application, remaining more or less peer-to-peer in terms of orientation, even though it has a central directory. Now, Skype is about to die because the acquisition with Microsoft has been approved. It's going to die in its original form. And Microsoft's going to shove Passport down its throat very soon. Mark my words. We'll get to that in a minute. So now both the original version of BitTorrent prior to the trackerless technology that came later, but the original version of BitTorrent and Skype both have some amount of central coordination required. And these were Achilles' heels in certain ways. The bit of central coordination in Skype is where the value from Microsoft to acquire it comes from. And the central coordination that was in BitTorrent, which was having a designated tracker, has been superseded technologically. So these two things, both exceptions, have grown in different directions. Worth remembering. So where am I? Okay. Now let's talk about who the big mainframe providers are, because I want to enumerate them because I'm going to I want to analyze them in relatively great detail. So we can talk about the major application categories that arose in the sort of dawn of networking era, and they're still all there. So with email was the first of these to move over to application service providers. So like Gmail, Yahoo Mail, Hotmail, all the huge wave of things that started in the 90s for doing hosted email, more or less completely captured the end-to-end client market for email. Not me. I still use Eudora. Not even the new Netscape version, which I despise because it looks too much like Outlook. I'm still on an old version of Eudora, which at some point I will have to, after it gets too creaky, discard with great wailing and gnashing of teeth. File distribution also became into hosted services. And probably the largest, best-known player, this is RapidShare now. Mega Upload has been taken down by force. There's MediaFire. There's endless number of these things that come and go. But this is one thing that used to be just someone's FTP server, and now those things went hosted, and that category has mostly moved on to major service providers. Discussion: what hasn't moved on to, what wasn't on forums or is in one of the integrated suites, is Yahoo Groups. There's certainly a foothold in the application service providers with that major application category. And finally, you have to talk about Facebook and its imitator, Google Plus, because this was the what's it called the social network category, and really should be seen as an integrated suite of software. And the integrated suite of network-based applications that had already been proven but never integrated into a single whole yet. So when I think about how to take down Facebook, I've stopped thinking about how to make a replacement to Facebook, which is what Google Plus is. How to create something that looks and acts like Facebook, but rather like, what particular application functionality does Facebook provide that you can target? Because the right way to go after someone that large is to nibble it to death and to attack it in very specific places with a lot of intensity in particular places, and then move to the next place rather than, I mean, the other strategies won't work. Trying to nibble it to death from all sides at once is guaranteed to fail. Okay, so Anatole was kind enough to make me some slides about the rise of evil. So let's see if this is going to behave. So, in terms of the major players I've mentioned, we'll start with IBM, the original evil. I can't hear anybody laughing, which is really unfortunate because I think Anatole did a bang-up job on these. And then we have, in chronological order, we have Microsoft. Now, Microsoft is evil by aspiration, meaning, remember they started in 75 as selling basic interpreters, and then they acquired MS-DOS and, always tried to get bigger. So Microsoft is no longer anywhere near on my top list of major evil actors, but they're always trying. They try a lot. And so next on our list is Facebook, who designed themselves to be evil. Mark Zuckerberg has a bug up his ass about privacy that he's trying to kill by hook or by crook. And he designed Facebook in many ways to go after that as a central distinguishing feature of his service. So of all these people, I hate Facebook the most, but I don't think they're the most evil. So then we have Apple, who spent years trying to be successful and finally realized that they could grab the brass ring, take the opportunity, deliver centralized services, and make sure that 2014 is nothing like 1984. I really, really want someone to do a fake version of that 1984 commercial of Apple's with Steve Jobs in the face of Big Brother saying, "Now it's our turn." And lastly, we have Google now with evil. And Google's been dragged into this for what are essentially competitive pressures for ad dollars. And the two ways in which they're most evil are pretty much pure imitations of their competition. So They have their own unique spin on it. They do have a lot of properties. They do have most of the advertising dollars. And I have the suspicion that their advertisers were threatening to leave Google unless they started giving them more personal information. So even though they started with reasonable intentions and they're still the best of the players, they have to be ranked in the top tier of bad actors at this point, which is unfortunate, but nevertheless true. So there I am. Excellent. Okay. At this point, I'm going to move to a different phase, and I should ask if anybody has any questions, exclamations, or things to interrupt at this point before I change themes, because that's pretty much the historical context that I'm going to talk through in the next section. Who's my moderator? I can actually hear near the computer.
Hi. It's me.
There you are.
Hi.
Anybody?
Are there any
You can.
questions? No questions. No questions here.
No
No.
questions.
It's finished. It all makes sense to us. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I mean, this is particularly the last half of this should not be news, but what I'm doing is setting forth some categories that I'm going to use in a minute. So what I want to do now is I'm going to give you some slides in a moment, but the question I have, which I really, really want to make sure I have a good answer to, is how did evil win? How did these things actually take over the market? It wasn't by accident, and it wasn't purely because of malice, right? They didn't win because evil always wins, and they didn't win just because they had too much money. There's a reason for all this. And so my characterization of this is that evil won by replacing personal woes with societal woes. So let me bring up that slide so you can see it. Desktop. There we are. So one thing to understand is that people's actual values, when you talk about value-oriented societies, are determined through their behavior, not what they say. So when people switch products, they are telling you what their values are by their deeds, and you can ignore what they say. And the evidence is that people have moved on to hosted services, moved to the iPhone, and moved away from the personal computer because they had good reason to. And if you don't assume that you have respect for the people who've made those choices, you'll never win. So have respect for those choices. Those are what people's actual values are. Now, the personal woes, and I'm going to list these. Basically, the next long section of this talk is going through all the personal and societal woes and talking and like enumerating them, because these are the things that you have to confront if you're going to do anything significantly different. And the first distinction I want to make is that personal woes are immediate. They're the things that cause you harm. Like a disk crash is an example I'll get to. That's something that causes you actual direct harm. And if you can put your data on the cloud and let the government have access to it and let it be analyzed for keywords in exchange for not having your disk crash, you've eliminated a personal woe and incurred a societal one. But for most people, that's a choice they're willing to make. So that's the circumstance we're in. There were a bunch of things wrong with personal computers as implemented that these large players have fixed, and people have switched over because of it. So you have to acknowledge that. All right. I'm using moralistic language because I feel I am on the side of good. I'm sorry, I won't apologize for that.
And we must applaud.
So there's a 3-point program here. Roman numerals 1, 2, and 3, and you've got to do all three, right? And this is, I think, perhaps the most important slide in this presentation, single slide in this presentation, because it gives you an agenda of what to try to accomplish. So the first one, and the reason I went through all of those traditional applications, is that you have to rewrite those applications, right? That's what people want. They want to use the computers for something useful. And so if you don't provide the applications they want, you don't have a hope of winning. And so you take your standard things like email, like discussion groups, chat. All those things are the targets of things that need to be written, right? Not infrastructure. Infrastructure comes second. That's the tail. You don't want the tail to wag the dog. This is the dog here, as it were. This is the thing that you want to target. Now, if you don't do a better job at all these old problems that the evil players have fixed, this is item two, you're not going to win, because people won't switch off the large things unless you're at least as good as they are. And the third one is that you can't use their methods, because their methods all involve centralization in one form or another. And for various reasons. All the reasons aren't identical. But you have to take a decentralization approach rather than a centralization approach. And that's hard, particularly for things like identification that have never been adequately solved right, PGP aside. So there's the agenda, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through all the personal and societal woes and talk about, I mean, I've gone through the applications, basically, and you all are familiar with what applications you use and what people want. So that's not really where I don't need to, in this talk, I don't need to enumerate those more than I have already. But the second and third lists are the places where we're going to go to. Okay, so I'm going to give you the summary list of the personal woes. The next slide after this is the summary litany of societal woes, and then I'll go back to video. Okay, so these are, in some sense, representative rather than exhaustive. And partly it's because I don't feel that my personal perspective should be taken too soon as being able to enumerate the exhaustive list of personal woes, even the most important ones. So these litanies that I'm listing here, I really want to invite them to be open to discussion and completion particularly. There's certain things that may not bother me, that bother other people, that I just haven't put here out of the fact that this is a first draft of this talk. So this is a place where I'm specifically inviting participation, is to complete these lists of problems that have to be overcome. So these are just the keywords. Let me just give you a few words on each of the keywords. Hardware failure, I mentioned first. Disk crashes are probably the worst one. You don't normally have this problem, but you did in the 80s of the machine suddenly losing power based on flaky power supplies, flaky connections. You had people that would just lose work because the computer suddenly failed. The blue screen of death is something that acts like a hardware failure, another thing that's mostly gone now. But there's a whole class of these things that people would rather do without. And mostly this is a problem of single points of failure, is that the way that PCs were engineered traditionally, and which hasn't changed yet, is that you don't have an IT department at your house, and you have a single point of failure. And that is an environment for the PC that has to completely change in order to be able to overcome the large evil players. Okay, item two are security breaches and malware. This is something I'm sure you all know a lot about, so I don't feel the need to go into it. But malware particularly, and not so much security breaches, but malware and viruses. There was a fellow who did some, Simon something, I met him at Hackers a few years ago. He studied discarded hard drives that he dumpster dived. He literally dumpster dived for old computers that had hard disks still in them, and then analyzed what was on them. And his conclusion is that these machines were all discarded because their installations had become so encrusted with malware that they were no longer usable as machines. And it was more effective for the owners of those machines to throw them away and start afresh than to try to recover the value of the hardware. That's a huge, important lesson on how bad it is for ordinary people who don't really understand software hygiene. I don't have a problem with it because, you know, I've seen the source code for some of these things and played with it myself. I know what to do, what to avoid doing wrong, and I've very rarely been bitten. But for ordinary people, this is a real problem. Okay, application brittleness, item three, refers to something very specific about bit rot, essentially, but the fact that the whole application lifecycle from delivery to upgrade to deinstallation is just a horrible mess. Item four doesn't have a good name, I realized while writing this up, but it's the fact that it's another one. It's another aspect of the single point of failure argument, that one's personal computing environment is bound to a particular machine as a rule, rather than to who you are. So when you use something like Google Docs to do things, you log in as yourself from anywhere, and your environment is based on your identity, not on a piece of hardware. So that's overall the right way to do things. And it's a problem with PCs as they exist today. Okay, spam, of course, is a problem. And the difficulty with spam is if you're going to naively try to move all of your email onto personal computer hardware, you have to figure out what you're doing about that. And the answer I have is probably the most mature piece of my thinking about in terms of technical work behind this thing. Isolation is another thing. I don't have a good word for it. I mean here personal isolation that leads to ennui and malaise, which is to say, computers don't really naturally talk to each other correctly without talking to everybody in the whole world and incurring security problems. So just getting your hardware to interface in a natural way with someone else's environment, still to my eye, is not a solved problem. I mean, if you want, you can set up an NSF server and set up SSH tunnels to talk to it so that you can share files. And you need someone who's reasonably aware to be able to do that and not have it fail to DDoS or subversion attacks. And it's just, to my eye, it's just not something that ordinary people can set up easily. And so there's a particular application I'll get to later that I think is low-hanging fruit on this one. Okay. Now here's the litany of social woes. So, of course, when I see this list, I get far more freaked out than when I see the technical problems. Mandatory identification, which is typical of Facebook, universal dossiers, which are typical of Google, involuntary disclosure, which is more typical of Facebook than others, but basically every major vendor has done. Prohibitions on device configuration, that's principally targeted at Apple and the iPhone and iPad, although Android is, in effect, not a whole lot better. Restrictions on free expression, which don't so much apply to Europe and the U.S. as they do to China, Syria, used to be Libya. If you're going to think about possible societal woes, you've got to make sure that you deal with free expression issues so that you don't regress. Not something I have to really argue in this crowd. And the last one is indignities toward innovators. And this, more than anything else, is why people hate Microsoft. Because they had this horrible habit of taking someone's great idea and stealing it just outright. The number of things that Microsoft has imitated and failed is larger than the number of things that they have imitated and succeeded, plus the number of things they have imitated and failed and then acquired. You have to have followed them for a while, particularly prior to the dot-com era, but they have spent huge amounts of money trying to steal other people's ideas and are mostly incompetent at it, which is kind of surprising. But for example, I had a really interesting conversation with a fellow named Jim King, who used to be head of Adobe's Advanced Technical Group. And he told me the whole story one afternoon about how Microsoft in the 80s had tried to put Adobe out of business at the time by making their own version of PostScript because they saw that Adobe was making money at computer things and Microsoft thought they ought to have that money. And so they tried to imitate it, and basically he went into some detail about how Microsoft was incompetent in certain core competencies that Adobe had, largely because Microsoft didn't understand what the real market was. So, you know, when I say Microsoft is evil by aspiration, it's mostly tempered by incompetence, which is thankful. All right. So there's the summary of these things. Now, what I'm going to do, let's see, time to go back to video. Right. there. What I'm going to do now is, you know, there's a dozen of these woes, and I want to analyze each of them in turn, because this is where the intersection of architectural and design concerns gets to technical implementation. So these woes that I'm talking about are the things we want to avoid by design, and now we can talk about how to write code that does the right thing. Okay, so, oh, you know what? I switched off to code. I have one more really important theoretical point to make, which is the difference between positive and negative liberties. And I'm going to put this slide up because this is actually easier to read, atypically. Desktop. Okay. Positive and negative liberties are ideas that were originally developed back in the 50s and 60s in two kind of separate essays, really independent of each other, Eric Fromm and Isaiah Berlin. Eric Fromm is the fellow from the Frankfurt School who developed the notion, who wrote originally on the authoritarian personality when analyzing what happened with the Nazis in Germany during World War II. And Isaiah Berlin is a immigrant philosopher into England who wrote an essay on the two kinds of liberties. And so the important things about negative and positive liberties is that they really do act differently. And if you don't really see the distinction between them, you'll make the wrong choices. And this is what happened with cypherpunks. This is the second to last bullet. The real problem that cypherpunks had at the end of the day is that it was almost exclusively focused on negative liberties and never really got around to articulating what the positive liberties it was seeking were. So think about this talk as a remedy for that old defect. Because the positive liberties are the things that people care more about. Now, admittedly, sometimes you have to deal with making a space before you can do anything useful, which was the state of the world with cypherpunks. Back then, 20 years ago, the PCs were fine. They had problems, but there was no mainframe pathology. There was certainly no Apple iPhone single installation thing, which would have been really unthinkably ludicrous 20 years ago, now a reality. But a negative liberty is the absence of a constraint, and that generally means a constraint that's by an external agent, some person or corporate interest, that's trying to prevent you from doing something. So the kind of essential example of negative liberty is slavery, where violence is used to constrain your life horribly down for providing economic benefit to the slave owner. That's the essence of that's like the essential core example of the absence of a negative liberty. Positive liberties are a little harder to get at, but basically if you can't walk, you don't have positive liberty to move around a city. If you don't have any money, you don't have the liberty to innovate technologically. These are basically things that you're able to do. And so, as a rule, unless the negative liberties are particularly obnoxious, as they are in politically repressive regimes, people seek positive liberties over more than negative liberties. They tend to matter more. And that's really the theme of the of analyzing the distinction between personal woes and societal woes. So as these things devolve into computing, right, here are the enemies of positive liberty: things that waste your time or duplicate effort. So disk crashes, right? Having to recover from a security crash. These are things that impair your ability to use your stuff, right? This is an enemy of a positive liberty. Enemies of negative liberty are basically everything to do with privacy, which I've enumerated there, and some other things about people trying to interfere with your life actively. So as a rule, right, the world we live in right now is not, the technical world of computing specifically in the commercial marketplace, is not so obnoxious that people are offended by the negative liberties yet. And I say yet, because give it time, and without a counter-reaction, people will start rebelling against it. But I personally don't want to live my life waiting 20 years for people to rebel against it. I'd rather be more proactive about it. So the next section is the 12 bullet points. and I'm going to leave this slide up for just a moment more. One of the things that I pretty much knew but verified while going through this thing is the following very significant fact. All of the personal woes that I identified are all in the category of enemies of positive liberty. And all of the societal woes are in the category of enemies of negative liberty. That, I think, is, in terms of other significant things about this talk, that's the most significant theoretical conclusion to take away from this, is that positive liberties matter more to the consumer as a rule than the negative ones do, which means if you want to promote cryptography, you need to promote something else first and let the cryptography ride along with it. I had a motto that never caught on in cypherpunks, but it was that cypherpunks is not the hacker privacy league, which is to say we're not writing privacy tools for ourselves, we're writing it for everybody else. Not an attitude that unfortunately particularly caught on well. People nodded and agreed with it, but they didn't follow it to its conclusions. And one of the paths it leads you on is to this distinction between positive and negative liberties. So I know a bunch of you are all excited about crypto, and it's one of the reasons I'm giving the talk, which I'm so glad with. But I want to really warn you that if you focus on cryptography to the exclusion of the other things people want, you're going to likely go down a dead end. And I hate to say that, but it's true, and I've done it myself. And in terms of getting code written, cypherpunks was not a huge success in that particular way. So we had certain important successes, but people don't encrypt their email as a matter of course nowadays. That's I consider that a failure of the technical agenda that we had 20 years ago. Still something that needs to be picked off. But you're not going to be able to simply get people to encrypt their email because encryption is cool or because you use it. It's going to have to tag along with some other thing that they want to be able to do. It's a hard lesson I had to learn. I would rather people not repeat that lesson in their own lives if they've got my experience and other people I've seen to benefit from. Okay. Back. Let's go through these. So hardware failure. So most of the personal woes have this theme that there's a centralized IT department. Now, that's not too surprising, but it's repeated over and over here again because the things that the centralized IT department does are each slightly different for each personal woe. Just because centralized IT departments are used to solve these problems doesn't mean that their replacements map one-to-one analogously. And in fact, they're almost all completely different. Even though centralized IT can address these woes and has eliminated them to great extent, doesn't mean that when you try to prevail over them that you want to create the analog of a centralized IT department and push all the services through. That's too close of a direct analogy in terms of process, and it won't work. So there's the behind-the-scenes IT staff for hardware failure, right? Basically, cloud services and storage, right? You have iCloud, I think it's what Apple's calling theirs. You have Amazon S3 for one kind of this thing. You have file Dropbox services, which we've talked about before. You've got Facebook and Google Plus. Any of these things that where you're storing work product, Google Docs is a particular example, they are all using some kind of virtualization behind the scenes to allow you to see a single application, no matter where it's running, on more than one machine. So transparent redundancy is one of the solutions from a technical point of view that has to happen to address hardware failure, which is unfortunate. I mean, this is the whole single point of failure thing, and it's so fundamentally different than the way PCs have been engineered that this really counts as something that basically needs to be started from scratch. Hesitate to call it groundbreaking work, but it basically is. It's something where even the basic concepts and models on what to do right are really not in place. And just to pick a very particular example related to cryptography, which to my mind does not have a proper solution yet and could provide a case study to do so, is if I've got a keyring with private keys on it, how do I make sure that that device doesn't crash and leave me keyless? Simple question. But to my knowledge, in my opinion, there's not a good solution to this. It involves certainly having keying material in more than one location. It means having it on locations that are not in your house, held with friends perhaps. Certainly more than one device. But I think that even the basic model about what hardware to use and who controls it and how you talk to people and what you do to recover, I don't think any of those things are worked out well yet. So it's a good solid place to start. Even if you're going to focus on keying material for implementation, the real issue is how do you take that principle and generalize it to the whole machine? Because that's what people care about. If their disk crashes, they don't want to lose everything on that machine. And so the same basic interaction that happens for keying material is what should happen with the machine as a whole. Okay. Next item. Security. Evil eliminates security by having centralized security staff. Hardly surprising there. They have highly leveraged people. One person there can serve thousands of users. They pay attention to all the security alerts. They stay on top of it, and they've got a kind of leverage over personal attention which cannot be overcome, I believe. No amount of security subscription services or remote things are going to be able to do as better to get the same leverage that you have on the personal side as IT departments have in these major players. I don't see that as ever being feasible. So if you're going to fix this, what do you have to do? Well, the first one is snide, but I can't help but saying, is we've got to get greater responsibility and a bigger ethos on developers not to deliver software that's full of crap. There's really, to my eye, not enough social pressure for delivering buggy software yet. And if you believe in the personal computer principle, you got to care about security, because it's one of these things that is a defect in positive freedom for people. Security failures act like hardware failures for the most part. They're, from the user's point of view, they don't really care so much why it's not working as that it's not working. So it still acts like a defect in their positive freedom. In terms of other technical means for security, dealing with malware in particular, I'm convinced that the basic operating systems have to start acting far more like virtual machine products on an ordinary basis. And so the motto I have is virtualize every single process and every single resource in it. And Anatole and I have talked a lot about this. If you want to know my thoughts in great detail, talk to him. He knows them. We've gone over through this a lot. It's a place where I think there's some good possibility to do active work, particularly if you want to hack on the Linux kernel. So toward this end, a couple of years ago, I ran into Kirk McCusick at a conference and asked him in the BSD kernel code what it would cost to give every process its own mount table for the disk, basically to jail every process. And he immediately started doing calculations in my head, which indicated, one, that he'd never heard the question, and two, I was going to get the right answer from him. And he kind of looked at me with a bit of surprise and goes, oh, really, not that much, as if he himself was surprised at what a modest resource load it would be to virtualize the file system on a per-process basis. So the principle of virtualization here is to restrict access to process this to a minimal number of resources they actually need. So you'd want to virtualize every damn thing in the process and then have an opt-in model for how things run on the machine. And that will go a long way to act as a second barrier after initial quality for making sure that stuff that's installed on the machine that starts misbehaving doesn't cause catastrophe. And the third particular technical thing recommendation I have is that application data, and this is more true about individual software for users that has the notion of a workspace in it, but can be applied to other things, is that data that's saved in by applications should not take the model that you have individual save points. It should be diachronic. It should be like a logging file system, particularly in order to enable rollback. So, for example, in the case of an email application, if you have a security failure and some problem with your email, or even more importantly, your keying software happens, you want to be able to roll back to a known good place or a known safe place. So rather than just trying to prevent security failures, we need ways of dealing with them after the fact in a systematic and principled way. And again, this is not something that's an ordinary part of application software yet. Okay. Application brittleness is the next one. And this I mentioned before is the issue of bit rot. So one of the reasons, I'm still on Windows boxes, and the reasons basically involve at least historical brittleness of Linux and BSD and their ilk. I hate doing sysadmin work. I really dislike it. I like focusing on what I want to pay attention to, and I really don't want to pay attention to other things. And so even though at this point I know people have upbraided me periodically that Linux works fine for that, I still haven't switched because I don't have a particular reason to at this point, having become comfortable with the way I interact with my machines, that I don't have to think about it, even though they run the ancient evil empire Microsoft's operating systems. Now, so my comments on this are specifically oriented at Microsoft, but I feel like you can understand the generality behind them. So the problem is that as you install things, as you upgrade things, as you deinstall things, you get just things stop functioning correctly. So old libraries start hanging around, old registry entries keep hanging around, things don't quite get uninstalled. Bad, you get version skew of things, you get actual hardware errors, you get occasional malware that went undetected that does stuff. All these things accrete over time. And while they don't accrete quite as fast as malware, they still accrete even based on poor software quality, absent malice, you still have much of the same thing. So the large evil players have eliminated this, again, by having staff, but they do their upgrades ad hoc. They only need to do it once, and their programming staff is on hand. So if there are problems, say, in data conversion, they can fix them immediately by running some custom SQL queries, say, against the stored data, and be done with it. That's a procedure that absolutely does not generalize to the personal computer case. And so, again, there has to be some new infrastructure built to allow this stuff to work better at the PC level. So I have a few comments on this, but the main one involves global variables. So if you view a single machine, like my laptop that this is on, as one program, and the program loader is simply calling subroutines for installed applications, that's sort of a high-level analogy, but more or less accurate, then if global variables are so bad in programming languages, why are there so many global variables in operating systems that are considered just hunky-dory? And the main one I mentioned before is the file system. That's publicly visible. On Windows, the registry is publicly visible and can be written to by anything. A huge cause of security woes back in the... Well, it's changing now, but used to be a huge cause of security woes by people changing registrations of COM objects and the like. Which had the effect of same moral analogy to changing a shared library. So that's one form of brittleness. Another form of brittleness is leftover stuff and hanging chads, as it were, things that are left over after installation. And the way I think to treat that is to treat the computer installation as a whole as a garbage collection problem, that you want to model in terms of dependencies, the kinds of things that are on the machine and what you want to save. So the data that's generated from a program should be tagged separately than the application. It should be able to be upgraded separately. But then when you upgrade, everything will go along with it. There could be some data which requires an old version. So as long as that old version of the data is around, you don't automatically uninstall the tool that allows you to manipulate it. So there's a bunch of things involving explicit modeling of dependency, and dealing with basically automatic deletion of things rather than manual deletion of things that I think is the right way forward for this kind of thing. There's another security issue in the brittleness thing, which is software upgrades. One of the main thing I really despise about Google Chrome is that it does silent updates in the background from a central server without any delay or interaction with the user. Google's pretty responsible overall technically, so I'm not so much worried about that from Google, but that works so well for them to be able to keep their Chrome user base happy that I suspect it will be imitated by people who do not have the same sense of responsibility that Google still has in that regard. And it's not something that I want to see generalized. So at the very least, there should be, right now, all software upgrades that automatically check for the things are doing so with their own ad hoc use. So at any given time, and I can't realistically uninstall these things, there are 6 or 7 processes running automatically on my machine that are dormant, waiting for a date semaphore to trigger for checking for updates for Java, for Chrome. There's one for Firefox. I'm trying to think of the ones I've had to deal with lately. There's the ones for Windows itself. And there's a few others that are just kind of there sitting up in my process table, all because there's no single architecture, single piece of software that enables me to discover that there's an upgrade, to determine whether I want to install it, to go to a third-party source, probably a friend of mine, to find out that I want to install it because it's not broken, etc. So one of the things in terms of the application cycle is just to be able to do upgrades well on a consistent basis and in a way that allows, in particular, that allows you to address the security problems of completely automatic delivery. Okay. Next item. And I'm just calling this item for short the machine orientation rather than the personal orientation. And the canonical example here is that when you upgrade a computer by replacing it, you've got to reinstall everything you've got installed in the other machine and then move all your data over. Complete waste of time. You're just basically running as fast as you can to stay in the same place. The way that the large players have eliminated this, and Google Docs is probably the most canonical example here, is that you log in and your data and your applications are tied to your login. That's something to imitate. I think that's the only one in this list of 6 that the basic approach taken by the large centralized evil players is the right approach. But in order to make it person-oriented, there's a lot of infrastructure in the background. First of all, you have to know who people are, which means there needs to be some kind of directory. And you don't want it to be a public directory because that makes it not a private directory. So you need models of people. You need a model of the environment. You need a model of data. You need a model of applications that can process the data. And this needs to be independent of particular machines. So in many ways, getting to user orientation rather than machine orientation is a generalization of the application development cycle I was just talking about. But it's more than that. It's significantly more than that. Okay, the 5th one on the list is spam. Spam just sucks your time. So the way people have dealt with it to date is they build centralized databases of bad players and centralized databases of bad spam, and they're in a coordination networks to detect it and suppress it as rapidly as possible. So there's a club of people who deal with a lot of email who have banded together to eliminate spam because it's in their mutual interest. But as a centralized club, they don't really have the ability or exactly the incentive even to push that out to the end user so that you can use all their good work to eliminate spam from your own life. And so the only way I know of dealing with this is to split your communications on principle into 2 halves, into a private sphere and a public sphere. Now, this has a lot of benefits, and this is when I said the most mature thinking on this. This is, I think, also necessary to solve anything involving key distribution. because key distribution simply acts differently depending on whether you're talking to someone you know or you're talking to some stranger or company over the internet. They have fundamentally different characteristics. The technical protocols and even the representations of trust that you need are probably different in those two things. So this is back when I was doing this, which was 8 or 9 years ago, spam was still a significant problem. And one of the positive freedoms I had intended before some things happened, I don't want to get into now, but before I shifted focus, getting rid of spam was one of the positive benefits I wanted to use to let cryptography and particularly the keying mechanisms tag along with. That would still be useful, although not quite as useful as it used to be. But simply to have two-part email, a public email and private email, is already something that current MUAs, mail user agents, the applications that you deal with mail, don't really support. They don't have the concept of the fact that you have two fundamentally different kinds of email you're dealing with. Might end up reading them the same, but there's got to be some representation that this is public email versus private email, and there's some difference in how you get the email, how you check it, and some of the sort of process things behind the scenes that need to be different. So that's a place where purely on the application side you can do the right thing. So the existing mechanisms, which generally fall under the rubric PKI, were developed really for the public sphere or for hierarchical organizations, and just leave them there. And the ones we need to develop in the private sphere have some cryptography I can talk about at greater length, but the basic principle is that a public key doesn't need to be a published key. Keying material is no longer nearly as expensive as it used to be, and you should basically have one. You should treat public keys as people used to treat private keys, and you should have one per person. And then ways of dealing with all that keying material, because you're going to increase the amount of keys you have by two orders of magnitude. It's certainly manageable. It's the right thing to do. It eliminates a lot of possibilities for traffic analysis, and I can go on at length about it. But the basic point is that you're splitting the public and private sphere. Okay, last one before break, which is this question of personal isolation. And so probably the vendor that's done the most to make this work better is Apple, and that's kind of typified by their Bonjour protocol, which is basically discovery for things on local networks that actually works right. And so, and that's one way. That's one way of going is just, you know, saying your traffic analysis and privacy to the wind. We're just going to publish everything. We're gonna let everyone know what's there, and then we're just not gonna let them in if we don't want them to use it. Well, I don't think that's gonna work over time. But the other main mechanism that people have used to do this is that they've just integrated the application suites into big, large glops. So the whole category of social networking software has arisen in order to, in my opinion, in order to deal with this problem that it's difficult to hook machines up to each other. I mean, it's still kind of non-standard, even in BitTorrent, which has had 10 years to really get it right, to be able to create a connection to another peer when both of you are behind firewalls. So it sort of works right now, sometimes. So just even the basic things on just being able to establish TCP connection between peers in the presence of other security mechanisms is one of these aspects of isolation that still, to my eye, needs a proper technical solution. And I don't think it needs a general solution. I'm not sure you need to implement it for BitTorrent, but you should be able to implement it with your friends. I mean, even if that means when you're prototyping it that you have to flash firmware onto your own routers to get the right protocol in place, that's a place to start. And then if you create the right kind of compatibility environment, you can eventually, you know, force it into the market. The other two points on this, on what to do right, is just like you want to for virtualizing out of single point machine failures, you want to orient your applications around people and not machines. So rather than, like, file transfer is the one I'll talk about later, but when I send someone a file, I want to send it to a person. I don't want to have to think about whether I send it to their email account or to their FTP site or to their file sharing service or whatever. I just want it to get there. And so the right user experience for that is that I should take the file and drag it to their icon with their head on it, and it should just get there. That application doesn't exist. the things that you could do to make computers talk to each other better in ways that don't require you to have a central service to do so. Okay. And the next thing we'll talk about, mandatory identification after the break.